Abby Elliott, cast member. You know, there's a lot of stuff happening backstage, and people seeing you from the bleachers, and you're changing right below them. They have little booths set up behind the stage, sort of underneath the bleachers, so when you're doing these quick wardrobe changes between the scenes, and you're getting your wig taken off or makeup put on, and you look up and see people in the bleachers pointing down at you going, "Oh, look!" and you're completely naked. There are definitely places where you can see everything, and you just look up and be like, "Hi!" Maya Rudolph. Going back to host was one of those second-level experiences that make you feel like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is really happening to me." When you first get hired on the show, you feel that way. Like, "My dreams have come true." Which is always a strange thing to experience in this day and age, because I feel like no one really expects their dreams to come true anymore. And when you actually have been in that place that long, and it becomes your home, and those people become your family, to turn around and host is like a whole other layer of, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is my life." I think that everybody's experience at SNL is different. And the thing that really made coming back so special for me is that the thing I really, really love, the thing I missed the most since I left, was getting to goof around and laugh with my friends. Those particular people make me laugh like nothing else, and the camaraderie and familiarity that you have with each other is so comforting. I had really missed that. It was a homecoming in a lot of ways.
John Hamm. It was strange. I just happened to be in town, and Lindsay was going to be hosting. I got a call, and they asked if I would be interested in doing this thing. It was never a real thing that I was quote-unquote on deck. That was the joke. It was, "Have you got somebody in the wings just in case?" Capitalizing on Lindsay Lohan's famous instability, which she was a good sport about. For me, it was just another chance to be on the show. Whenever I'm in town, they call and say, "Will you do this? We'd love to have you do this," and blah, blah, blah. I say no a lot, too, but I do consider a lot of those people friends, and it's nice to be thought of in a positive way. And God, you make so much money doing it! $500 or $600! You can really clean up being a guest star at SNL.
Lindsay Lohan, host. It was funny because we actually had another opening. We had a political one where John Hamm was going to play Kennedy, and we ended up not using that one, but we still wanted John to be involved. That's when we just put him in the audience. That was really funny.
Michael Shoemaker, supervising producer. Lindsay was great. I think you worry about every host, until you don't, and there's no way of telling. You can't call a good show on a Wednesday. None of us do. You kind of can't call it until after dress, and even then. Because you never know how air is going to turn out. You never really stop worrying until the after party. Each week you think it's going to go one way, and then a read-through informs you it's going to go in a completely different way. But even with people who are not professionals, if you find a way to make them charming in their unprofessionalism, then you win.
Lindsay Lohan. The last time I hosted, I was really nervous. I hadn't been there in a long time, like 4 years. I don't know why I was so nervous that time, but I was also going through a transitional phase, just personally, so I didn't feel as comfortable in my own skin. It was really crazy because the Friday night before, Kristen and a bunch of us had done a pre-tape segment, and we were still in the pre-tape until 6 a.m. Saturday. Then I had to go to the studio to do photos, so we were up for almost 2 days straight. When you do pre-tapes, you have to shoot them really early or really late, and we shot this one really late Friday night. It's fun because you're laughing and goofing off the whole time, but it's still grueling. But it's a really good feeling, going there and being around everyone and knowing there is such love there, and that it's completely mutual. I remember someone in the press said, "She's reading her lines." But everyone reads the cards. I actually like to memorize the cards so I don't have to look at them. But I was so nervous in one of the skits, and all the guys kept laughing, and I kept laughing during it. Lindsay Shukas. When Lindsay Lohan first hosted, I was like a kid with her. I've known her for 12 years. The first time she hosted, she was a teenager, and I was 22, and I really loved her. She was able to kid-sister me each time she came on the show. The last time she hosted, I felt a lot of pressure on my shoulders, and the show's shoulders, to make it a good show. On a Sunday, the worst thing in the world is if you feel like it wasn't a good show. I really feel like it's on my shoulders to help try and pull out the best version we can for someone, especially if they're not a comedian. With Lindsay, Lorne and myself and the rest of us really wanted to help her put her best foot forward.
Bill Hader. I really didn't enjoy having Justin Bieber around. I didn't hate the guy. I just wasn't into it. I'm pitching jokes to this kid? I was having a weird week because that was the week I told Lorne that I was leaving the show. I think that whole week was just bad for me, so I partially blamed Justin Bieber for it, I guess. There was one sketch where we all had to dress up as him. I felt like an old man. I'm a father. Why am I dressed up like this guy? What's going on right now? Sometimes you have people who are not your thing and they host the show, but sometimes they surprise me. Someone comes in and you're like, ugh, we have this person. And then by the end of the week, I'm like, I love this person. I have nothing against Taylor Swift, for instance. I just don't listen to her music. And then she came in and I was thinking, how wonderful and funny is this girl? She's so talented. That's how it always is, with the exception of Bieber. He's the only one who lived up to the reputation. I think that's the only time I felt that way in my 8 years there. Without a doubt, when a friend of yours is hosting, for me someone like Paul Rudd or Seth Rogen or Jonah Hill, odds are you would have a light show. I have no idea why it works out that way. It's so weird. Your friend would be hosting and you'd be really excited, and then you wouldn't be in the show. Or you'd have one good thing in it and that was it, and you're just going, how did that happen? And then along comes someone like Taylor Swift, and that was one of the best episodes I ever had. When she hosted, I had a killer episode, and she was a blast. Robert Smigel, writer. Back in 1999, that was the era where you had to try and turn every SNL idea into a movie. People had pitched me on the ambiguously gay duo, but I didn't go for it. Too one-dimensional. Instead, Adam McKay and I wrote an ex-presidents movie. I figured the four living ex-presidents were at least two-dimensional. That wound up becoming just a graphic novel. Then I had the idea to make Ace and Gary live-action, which opened up the characters. Lorne and I talked about using Alec Baldwin, but the rights to the sketch, because it had started on the Dana Carvey show, were very complicated. So it just went away. But 5 years later, Jim Carrey worked on Bruce Almighty with Steve Carell, and they got to talking about the idea, and Jim asked if the movie could be developed for him. So Stephen Colbert and I wrote an entire movie script for Jim Carrey, and then at the end of the day, Jim's advisors decided they didn't want him to wear leotards with a padded ass at this stage in his career. So it disappeared again. Years later, Lorne talked to John Hamm about the script, and he was into it. I was no longer on SNL, but I suggested we could do a short live Ace and Gary for the show, and maybe that could generate some studio interest. Akiva had this great idea that they get zapped into live-action humans, and we got Fallon for Gary, and Colbert and Carell, the cartoon voices, agreed to play the bad guys. I was touched that Carell actually flew in from L.A. just to appear in it as a villain, one that half the audience didn't even realize was Carell, I think, until they saw the credits. We had a lot of fun shooting, and after that the director, Jason Wolliner, and I had to work non-stop at SNL for a few days to get the thing done. But then, while I was still facing a ton of editing, I got a call to audition for This Is 40 for Judd, so I snuck out of the edit that day, pretending I was going to be gone for just a half hour, and went to the audition. The truth is, no one would have cared, but I'm a good self-starter when it comes to guilt. The sketch was presented as a typical TV funhouse and a regular Ace and Gary cartoon, So if I had been watching at home, I would have been like, oh, this is kind of nice, but really, do we need another one of these? But within a minute or two, it suddenly turned into live action, and it was one of those things that we kept as quiet as we could, so nobody would find out in advance. I just wanted it to be a big surprise on air. It was very well received, but obviously it didn't become a movie. It would be pretty expensive for a comedy, in fairness. My agent followed up with the studio, and it was, we want to talk to Robert about a talking dog movie. There's this thing on the internet where this dog's mouth is in perfect sync with funny things that a human's saying, and we think that could be a movie, so can we meet about that? Colbert and I still like the script, though, so someday I'll probably harass Channing Tatum and Taylor Lautner into getting it done. James Downey, writer. The biggest risk to doing political comedy is you always seem to have a choice. Am I going to piss off the audience by trying to get them to laugh when they don't like what I'm saying? Or am I going to kiss their ass and get this tremendous wind at my back by sucking up to them and agreeing with them on all the issues and validating their opinions? The second way makes me feel like I cheated. It makes me feel like I won the cross-country race, but my mom drove me part of the way. I'm prouder of myself if I go, guess what? I know you're probably going to think I'm making a political statement here that you violently disagree with, but I'm going to make you laugh anyway. I did a piece that got a lot of attention in some circles. Lorne was scared shitless of it and tried to kill it and buried it at the very end of the show. But it was about the Duke LaCrosse case, and I had Amy doing Nancy Grace. The piece got huge laughs, and I was astonished because it was about rape. One thing audiences know is that there's nothing funny about rape. And the other thing they know is that there's no such thing as a false accusation of rape. That's comedy audience culture, right? It's PC culture. It's the reason why Chris Rock says he cannot get white audiences to laugh about his stuff about niggers versus black people. He goes, I have a right to say that stuff, but white audiences, I know they like it, but they won't laugh if there's people watching them. I gotta say, I respect more people who head into the teeth of an audience, whether it's going down to the Deep South and making fun of fundamentalist Christianity, or going to Manhattan and making fun of PC. I'm sure there are a lot of people in comedy who completely share every fucking detail, jot, and tittle of the Obama administration agenda. And all I can say is, to the extent that you're sincere and that's really the way you feel, then you're a very lucky person, because guess what? You're going to have a very easy career in comedy, because audiences will always applaud. They may not laugh, but they'll always give you a huge ovation. That's Bill Maher, you know? Lorne Michaels. In the 70s, the thing I dreaded the most was being defined, you know? I wanted to just keep moving forward and to keep changing. James Downey. You used to hear all the time, I'll say this for Saturday Night Live, just when you think you know what their take is going to be on something political, they will surprise you and do something different. And that hasn't happened in the last 3 years of the show. We haven't done anything that anyone would be surprised by. I thought in 2012 we got really repetitive. There were so many Republican debates, and I thought it was a mistake, but the decision was, if they do a debate, we do a sketch. It's going to be one for one. I thought it ended up being kind of the same thing. There were a lot of Republican gaffes, but we would just sort of dramatize the gaffe, as opposed to making a meta-comment about it. We were replicating Rick Perry's brain freeze, replicating the booing of the soldier that asked about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Because Jon Stewart is a show that comments on things that happened, it made us feel like Stewart made that point. So it felt like we were just sort of echoing what everyone else was doing. Considering all the dozens of cast members who've left Saturday Night Live since the first group packed up and followed Lorne Michaels out the door in 1980, it would have been virtually impossible to make a fuss every time somebody split. How did it happen, then, that in May of 2012, cast and crew said elaborate and tearful goodbyes to Kristen Wiig in an on-air party disguised as a sketch, with His Lordship Michaels coming out from the wings to dance with Wiig and give her a sweet send-off? There were many reasons, at least as many as the number of characters that Wig had played and helped invent in her 7 awe-inspiring seasons on the show. After a period in which SNL was commended for the number of smart women in key positions both on and off camera, such stars as Tina Fey and Amy Poehler had flown the proverbial coop, depleting the female population. To lose Wig was to lose an entire chorus of recurring characters, a major blow at any time, but especially then. And that's one of the reasons why she got a party, or really an observance, a moment for the show to stop and register an unusually fond farewell. Special guest John Hamm, who had earlier appeared in the cold open, also stayed for the goodbye sketch, set at a high school graduation. As the head of the school, host Mick Jagger doled out diplomas to students and told the audience that the one played by Wig was ready to become a man. Then he announced a song to say goodbye, at which point the band broke into the Rolling Stones' oldie Ruby Tuesday. Wig ripped off her black graduation robe and threw it away, and the two of them began to dance. Before the sketch was over, Wig danced with everybody, all the men, including Andy Samberg, who literally swept her off her feet and briefly held her in the air, and the remaining women, and then finally Michaels, who normally dislikes public displays of emotion. But the event met his principal criterion for material on the show. It was funny. Also, it was bittersweet and even poignant. They were saying goodbye not just to Wig, but also to the characters she and fellow writers had created and perfected. Among them, Shanna, the bosomy office bombshell who made male employees loopy with lust until she went into grotesque, tasteless poses. Mindy, the out-of-it Broadway diva who screwed up all her appearances on a password-like game show. Cat, of Garth and Cat, the chronically unprepared folk duo who tried to fake songs on the spot during Weekend Update. The strange woman with the tiny hands, who barged into reruns of the Lawrence Welk variety show and plucked at bubbles. And that incorrigibly naughty girl, Gilly, who looked upon everyone else in the world as competition for attention and therefore sabotaged them as best she could. Wig played real people, too. All of them with a sardonic edge, whether it was Nancy Pelosi, a tipsy dipso Kathy Lee Gifford, a quirky and baffling Bjork, or Jamie Lee Curtis, who in mock spots for a supposedly healthful yogurt would register its purgative effects right there on camera. Michaels looked genuinely touched as he took his turn dancing with Wig. Then he flashed her a benedictory smile, reminiscent of the one that the Scarecrow gave Dorothy before she left Oz for Kansas, a smile that seemed to say, "It's going to be all right." Bill Hader. It's a testament to Kristen that she came back after Bridesmaids was such a big hit. I'm not going to name names, but some people who were working at the show said, "If that happened to me, I would not come back." She was at the table read, writing sketches, doing everything, and we were like, "You're one of the biggest comedy stars in the world right now, and it's so awesome that you're here." That's the funny thing, though, too. The people who came up with Kristen weren't thinking she'd just become a star, because we had already seen what a big star she was. By her first season, she would come out on her mark, and the audience would just start cheering. I remember I was doing all these impressions and stuff like that and trying so hard to get just one character on the show. And Kristen would so easily get out there and just boom, 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 like Penelope and this and that. And these things are destroying, they're so good. That was the nice thing about our group. I never felt a sense of jealousy. Everyone was very happy for each other. There was something about her that clicked with the audience. They would get excited. Andy had a very similar thing. It just clicked. After Lazy Sunday and those things came out, people would get excited. So we weren't that surprised. It was the newer cast members who were suddenly like, "Holy shit, we're working with this massive star."
Kristen Wiig. Honestly, it never crossed my mind to leave the show early, for so many reasons. A. I had a contract for 7 years and I wanted to fulfill it. To me, it wasn't like, I'm going to be on this show and then better things are going to come. I wanted to be on the show. It was really hard for me to leave even when I did, and just because Bridesmaids made a lot of money didn't affect how I felt being on the show or change my life in that way. I had known pretty much from the beginning that I was going to do 7 years and that would be it. Not because I wanted to leave, but 7 years is a good chunk of time, and I was excited to try other things and also make way for new people to come in. I know that Lorne knew I was leaving just from being around the show. We can't really keep any secrets around there. Plus, my contract was up, and I didn't renegotiate for another year, so he knew. But of course I knew that I still had to sit down with him and talk. I believe we were at dinner, and I just said, "Well, are we going to talk about this?" And it was really hard and emotional. The last show of my first season, I went up to Lorne and just thanked him. I was just overwhelmed from the year, and I got a little choked up, and then when I left, I got really choked up. So I started and ended my experience there crying in front of Lorne. It was really, really, really difficult. And it's hard for people in the outside world to understand, I think, about leaving that show, because it really is your family. Even the hosts come in, and after spending just 1 week with us, it's like we're friends and we know each other, and we go through this crazy experience, and that's just 1 week. So you do that 22 times a season for 7 years, it becomes your life, and when you leave, it's very, very strange.
Lorne Michaels. Colin Jost wrote the Kristen goodbye sketch as a graduation ceremony. At that point, I don't think Andy was 100% sure he was leaving. Jason was agonizing about it. This was the last show of the season, and Mick was hosting. It was too long at dress, and we just didn't know whether we'd be doing it, whether there would be time, especially since it was going to be at the end of the show. And so because of that, I don't think there was a lot of thought given to how emotional it would be, until suddenly there it was, and we were doing it. Ruby Tuesday was playing. Each cast member danced with her. It was just a magical thing. People in the audience from the old cast even came up on stage. Kristen gave everything to this show her entire time here.
Kristen Wiig. Usually when someone leaves the show, at the table read people write a goodbye sketch. It gets slipped into the pile so people don't read it ahead of time, and it's the last sketch of the day, and usually there's a lot of tears. Colin Jost wrote that sketch, and I thought it was just for the table read, and when it got into the show, I was completely shocked. I was happy because he wrote such a beautiful, sweet, simple thing. And also, I knew I wanted to somehow say goodbye, but didn't know how to do it. I didn't know if I should go on update. I had never been on update as myself, and I didn't want to get up there and just start bawling my eyes out. We tried thinking of characters leaving, but I couldn't think of anything. It was almost 1 a.m., and it was my last show, and there wasn't a lot of time left, and there was an issue of it even making it into the show. So I didn't know if I was going to be able to say goodbye. I changed clothes quickly so that when Mick Jagger's talking, I'm putting on my cap and gown and running out to the stage to sit down. It ended up making the show, and it was just one of the best experiences that I've ever had. I can't even really put it into words. When Lorne came on stage, that really got me. I mean, he was there during rehearsal, but it just seemed so final on air. He was out there in his suit, and it was just... Oh my God, I could get emotional thinking about it right now.
John Hamm. I was incredibly pleased to be asked to be part of that, because Kristen is a very good friend of Jen and myself. I love her. She's an insanely talented, lovely human being. It was her last show. She goes, "Will you do something in it?" And I'd never been in the cold open and gotten to say, "Live from New York," but the sketch called for a lot of singing, and I was nervous about that, because at that point I had a very injured voice. But for whatever reason, adrenaline or something kicked in. Rehearsals were disasters, but I said, "Okay, guys, I promise I'll be able to sing in a normal way." I had taken the red eye, got there Friday, rehearsed about twice, but I was able to do it, and it was an absolute blast. They had this party for it being the last show of the season. It was insane. And I'm standing there, Jen and I watching, and I said, "How cool is this?" And the guy says, "Yeah, pretty cool, isn't it?" And I turned, and it was Mick Jagger. It was really cool, and it was beautiful in a way that only SNL can bring, that live experience. It's the last real vestige of that that we have. Eric Kenward, writer. This is not to say anything negative about anyone who came before this, but I would say, especially since 2005 or 2006, I have really noticed this feeling of extended family, that people who used to be part of the show now come and go very freely, that people are always available in a way that they weren't my first 2 or 3 years at the show. People are not on call, but you always know that if we want them to do something, they will try and make it. For people like Amy Poehler and Seth, certainly, that ideal was very important to them. So I think that started to be more a part of the DNA of the show, which isn't to say that it wasn't in there before. It just became more pronounced. We had one of those moments where we were sitting in Lauren's office. It was a Thursday night, and we were talking about what we could possibly do for a cold open. The Live Sound of Music had just been on that week, and we were talking about when the kids in it made those entrances. They sort of looked like the entrances Kristen's character Denise made in our Lawrence Welk sketches. And then Kristen just happened to come by Lauren's office. She was in the building to do Jimmy's show and stopped by to say hi. We said, "We were just talking about you." And we just started riffing on the idea of this cold open. I remember Lauren said, "Hey, if you guys have something here, just keep talking about it. I'm going to go get a haircut, and when I get back, we'll make a decision about this." By the time he returned, we had the whole thing hammered out. Kristen agreed to do it, and we started calling all of the departments and had the set made. It happened that quickly. This isn't necessarily typical for SNL, but it's kind of cool when it does happen, when there are lightning in a bottle, let's put on a show kind of moments. I think that's probably one of the coolest things about SNL, when the show is at its best, and the kind of thing that SNL can still do that no other show can really do. It's also a testament to Lorne that he has things organized loosely enough that there is space for things like that to happen. I certainly have worked for people at other jobs or on other gigs, producers who have such a predetermined conception of what a show is going to be that there's no room for new stuff or invention. And putting a piece like that into production on a Friday would be very scary, at the very least super nerve-wracking for a lot of people. But for Lorne, it's just a matter of course. Dan Aykroyd, host. When I went back to do the Justin Timberlake show, it wasn't Lorne that invited me and Steve Martin. It was Justin, because he liked wild and crazy guys. When he was a kid rehearsing Disney, he used to watch our reruns, and he always wanted to do that sketch and be one of those characters. So he called Lorne, and Lorne, of course, wouldn't stand in the way. But the idea of having the old guard back, unless you're talking Kristen Wiig and Will Ferrell and other hot stars of today, it's unlikely that Lorne would call and have me or Chevy back. That's not what the show is now. He's got to develop his new cast. But we're always ready to serve if it's good and it helps. The show is about the future. It's about building that legacy in the audience of young people who need this satire, who need to see it.
Kristen Wiig. Being on that show pushes you. The whole week, depending on how you look at it, can be a very stressful week, and it can also just be really fun. I think people handle stress differently, and I think I just made a decision early on that I wanted to have fun. I know that sounds so simple and stupid, but I just didn't want to leave the show and look back and say, "I wish I would have had more fun." Because when you really think about it, doing SNL and working with all of those amazingly funny, cool people is the most fun job in the world. Truthfully, sometimes it was really hard. The schedule is difficult. Sometimes you feel like you've done everything you can do and you have no more ideas. Sometimes you're so exhausted that you almost fall asleep during rehearsals, even if you're standing up. You can never get sick, and you don't see a lot of daylight. Sometimes you work so hard on a sketch and it gets cut and you're gutted. But that being said, it is the best place on earth because of how much it challenges you. When you get through it, you feel like you've really accomplished something, even if you feel like you had a bad show. And if you did, you have to let it go because the show keeps moving. Show week starts Monday, and you have to show up with new ideas and do it all over again. And you can't wait for it to come.
Andy Samberg, cast member. I had told Lauren about my leaving probably the night before. In retrospect, I think maybe I would have been better off making it more clear. It was definitely odd for me because obviously Kristen got the proper send-off, not only because she announced it, but because she was one of the best cast members of all time. And I thought, I kind of did it on my own terms, but maybe it would have been nicer and cleaner to have made an actual announcement before the season ended. There was a big part of me that didn't want to leave. It was the job I'd always wanted. What it came down to is this. I just couldn't physically and emotionally do it anymore. Saying goodbye was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, because at that point it's more than just a job. It's family. It's like telling your parents you're moving out, and they're not ready for you to leave. And you're also talking to the guy who gave you the break that changed your life, so you don't want to disappoint him. Lauren said he'd prefer I stayed, but I think he says that to everybody who's going to leave. Everything I've done in my career, I've always worried about whether Lauren would think it was a good idea. That's always been in the back of my mind. He sticks with you when you leave. I'll never forget how much my life changed because Lauren said, "Yeah, let's give that guy a shot." Fred Armisen, cast member. I've known these people for so long and in such close proximity that I felt like this is my family. And I know that people say that about casts of TV and movies and other stuff, but 10 or 11 years? It's pretty intense. I believe in the way that Lorne picks people for the cast. I really do think there's a DNA for the kind of person that could end up on the show. And I think we all have it in common, just the way we look at things. And I felt close to everyone. It was really great.
Abby Elliott. I felt as if that was my family, and then it wasn't. The show is, you know, sliding doors of people. That's sort of how it works, and how it has always worked there, with people coming and going. And it was my time to go. Kate McKinnon, cast member. I was in a holding deal with CBS for pilot season, and I had to get out of the deal in order to do the audition for SNL, and I was losing half the money from the deal. So it was like a $30,000 audition, which is a lot of money. I was torn if I even wanted to audition because I thought I could have a guarantee of this CBS thing and that would let me live for half a year. Or I could audition. I'm a very practical person and I thought, maybe I shouldn't gamble all this money away. But friends said, "You're insane! You have to do it!" I was in Culver City, Los Angeles when Lauren called. I had been tipped off that I might receive a call, but I couldn't imagine that that's what that was. But that's what that was. Lauren said, "I'll cut to the chase. This is your good news phone call. We would like you to come work for us." I said, "Well, thank you." "Really?" I called my manager and my agent because it was really a team effort and I wanted to tell them. We're very close. And then I called my mom. I wasn't that nervous my first night on the show, because I assumed that my sketch would get cut and I wouldn't actually have to do it. I thought, this is good practice, and I won't have to do it on TV. I was glad when it didn't get cut, of course, but I just thought something catastrophic would happen, like my heart would explode and my mother would be watching and have to run to the Long Island Railroad and come and rescue me or something. I wasn't thinking clearly. I was a little overwrought at the time. It was a very stressful week.
Fred Armisen. I was already doing Portlandia, and it was already feeling that I should focus more on that. I hinted that maybe I should think about leaving, and then Lauren asked me to stay longer, and I thought, okay, yes, that feels good. And I knew Bill was staying, so I thought, okay, Bill will be there, so we can go through this together. And, okay, next year will be my last year. And then when that year came up, I was doing Portlandia and having to fly back and forth a lot. And that's when I thought, this is a lot of flying, and I'm very focused on Portlandia, so maybe this is the year to go. Bill Hader. After Kristen and Andy left, we were like, how is this going to work? That was big. And then John Mulaney left, too. That was big. So my last season, Bobby Moynihan just takes it. You know what I mean? He started doing amazing stuff and working really hard. And Vanessa doing great stuff, Taryn, everyone just raises their game.
Vanessa Bayer. I wrote Bar Mitzvah Boy with a couple of other people. That was a voice that I had done, a little bar mitzvah boy in my stand-up in Chicago. And then there was a sketch that was written when I did my first year, and the writers put me in it as the bar mitzvah boy. I don't know why. I guess they knew I was Jewish. So I got to do that voice. And then we were trying to figure out a way to bring it back, and we tried scenes with me as Jacob, and it didn't exactly work. So we finally figured out to do it on Update, and then it felt right. I feel like the character is a version of myself, almost. I went to bar mitzvahs every weekend in the seventh grade. I have a brother who's 2 years younger, and a lot of people who know him think I'm doing an impression of him because of the gestures. You know how little boys are with their hands? How they will wipe their nose or something like that. Their hands are just awkward. I'm usually really excited just before going on Update. I always have something in my hand, like ointment, and I always am trying to remember that first line so I can say it without looking at my binder. So a lot of it is me learning that line. Then you can sort of see the audience from far stage left, so I'm always interested in, like, can they see me or not? And there's a million weird things I can be fixated on, like the chair I sit in has to be the lowest it can be. So I always ask the stage manager if he checked that. Yeah, I checked it.
Bobby Moynihan. When I did Snooki, you could feel the audience go, "We like that you're making fun of her." And I was like, "I'm going to end up being painted orange every week now if this girl keeps on doing stupid things."
Nassim Pedrad. Arianna Huffington reached out to me and invited me to the White House Correspondents' Dinner a couple years ago. She was incredibly supportive and seemed to be happy with the impression I was doing of her. It was amazing. I had never really been immersed into the D.C. scene like that. Nobody put me on the spot. But I think that's because Daniel Day-Lewis was at the table next to ours, and he was all anyone could focus on. Including myself.
Fred Armisen. I have never not done Ian Rubbish ever since I was literally 15 or 16, except for the fact that it's called Ian Rubbish. I've got to give Seth Meyers credit for that. He came up with the concept. He's the one who said, "What if there was a punk who's pro-Thatcher?" Because she had just died. That scene of those people from 1977 in London, those are my gods. That was a no-brainer for me. Kenan Thompson, cast member. I would do What's Up With That every single show if I could. It's a fun one. I think everybody has fun in it and watching it, so it's like a perfect little storm. Fred Armisen. Garth and Kat was a very simple, very easy thing. Kristen and I used to do it in the hallways on writing night, when I'd see her and we'd just go, "Hey, do you know this song?" And I'd start singing it, and she'd sing along even though it was made up, and we did this so many times that we thought, "We have to do this on Update." And we just came up with this thing where they thought they were very overly prepared to sing a song, but they were actually very underprepared.
Kate McKinnon. Bieber wasn't too upset by my impression of him, but he wasn't pleased. I don't think I wouldn't want to contribute in any way to a bad situation for him, or make him feel in any way made fun of. I am very, very concerned about making fun of anyone. I don't do anyone I don't like, and I actually really do like him and want him to know that. That it's coming from a place of admiration and love. Yes, it's a little tricky, But Lauren's style is that nothing can ever be mean, which I completely agree with. And so, you know, we do make fun of people, but it's always that we're just, like, taking a kernel of what we find fascinating or entertaining about that person and highlighting it. It's not in the spirit of trying to really cut them down.
Bill Hader. I had a 7-year contract and extended it when my daughter was born because I wanted to make a little more money. And then my 7th season, Andy and Kristen left, and John Mulaney and Simon Rich left. So all these people that I was used to working with were leaving the show. I was on the fence. And then my 8th season, during the Christmas break, my wife and I decided it's time to move to L.A. She's a director, and she was getting offers to direct television, and we have a family now, we have 2 kids, so maybe it was time to not do this anymore. A lot of people wait to tell Lauren at the end of the season, but I was going to be looking for houses in L.A., and I thought it was really disrespectful to do that with him not knowing about it. So I said to him, "Hey, I'm moving to California." People always told me that you cry in those meetings. Kristen said she cried. I think a lot of people cry because it's huge. It's a big, big decision. You're leaving this place where you learned everything. It's leaving home. That was the thing, I thought. SNL's like college. Dan Aykroyd said it's just a big place where you learn about show business. You learn how to act, write, direct, deal with giant movie stars, deal with failure, deal with giant success. And it just humbles you, and you learn and you grow there, and now you're leaving it into the unknown. And it's not like school where you graduate. You can stay there as long as you want. So in the moment where I was telling Lauren, "I'm not graduating, I'm actually leaving my home, you know that's what this is, my family," I thought I was going to pass out. I didn't think I was going to cry, but the room spun. I just thought, "Oh my God, I can't believe I said I'm leaving." And Lauren said, "Well, let's wear this for a while." That was what he said. "Let's see how we feel when May comes around." And I said I was looking at houses, and he said, "Okay," and that was it. And then I would be on the floor before a cold open, and he would walk by and say some little thing like, "You're going to miss this." You know, very funny and sweet. Fred Armisen. As the months went, Bill and I just kind of knew. We went through it together, and it was really nice when we both were like, "This is our last Christmas show." I talked to Lauren about it, but I think in January or February I made it more clear, and he wanted to keep it more open, which is fair. So it just remained an ongoing discussion until the very last month. I love SNL. I loved it, but I knew it was time to go. It's really strange. When Amy Poehler left, I asked her the same question about knowing when it's time to leave, and she said, "You just know. You know inside. You go, 'I think I'm done.'" And that's exactly what it was like. I thought, "Now I feel like I can go." Bill Hader. Lauren doesn't like it when people leave the show, obviously, and I think there's always a part of him that thinks, "You want to leave right now because it's the end of the season and you're tired, but let's see how you're feeling in August when you haven't been here for a while, and it kind of dawns on you that you're not going to have this job, and how much you love the job, and you'll come back." Lorne doesn't like it when people do big goodbyes. For the same reasons, he doesn't like send-offs for cast members, because he always thinks, "Don't do a big send-off when I can talk you back into staying." Fred Armisen. I think it was a very clear sort of pass from my Obama to Jay Farrow's Obama. He did an impression of him that was really good. It was great. It made sense. I'm speaking for Lorne without him actually having said this, but I think maybe he wanted to make sure that Jay was settled into the show before he took on something like that. He just needed a little time there to get himself set. And then Lorne called me about it, and I told him, "I'm a soldier for the show. So whatever he wants me to do, that's what I do." He said that we should talk about changing Obama, as if they were still undecided. I let him know, "Whatever you want, I'll do it, I won't do it, I don't care. I love being on the show. I love doing him, and I'd love to not do him." Jay is so talented. It was also somewhat obvious that I'm not going to be there forever. That was towards the end of my tenure, even though I hadn't announced it, so it made all the sense in the world. Jay Farrow. I got the call over the summer about doing Obama. Freddie's the best guy in the world, and we talked about it, and he was just so supportive, and Lorne was like, just work on it and get it ready. And then I was in front of the cameras doing it. Oh boy, that was scary. My heart was racing. I felt like I almost had a heart attack. There was so much pressure. And I was 24. It's a lot of pressure, especially when it's talked about and in such regard, you don't want to let people down. One thing with Obama is kind of like, it takes a minute to get to the point, so I want two patties, lettuce, two sesame seed buns, another piece of bread in between. Bill Hader. I didn't do any impressions before SNL. My manager said, part of your audition is going to be impressions. So when we did those shows for Lorne, I was essentially the Italian guy doing impressions, and I had to learn how to do him. I think my first one was Al Pacino giving an acceptance speech at the Emmys. I sat in my car and just kept doing it and listening to it, and the trick came where I said, I shouldn't watch them in movies. I should find interviews or documentary footage. Something felt fresh about that. So you're not just doing their persona from the films, you're doing them more like people. When I got the show, I didn't really know where I fit in, because I came in with Andy and Kristen and Jason, who were all crazy talents. I felt very lucky, but I said, okay, if this is the A-team, where would I fit into this ensemble? I thought that I should probably do impressions, because that Al Pacino impression went over pretty well. So it was like that. It was never anything that I planned on. It was just, oh, that went well. So let's go down that road, and that's what this ensemble needs right now. They don't need me doing videos, because Andy's doing that. I'd work on characters, but Kristen and Jason are killing it as far as characters are concerned. So let me try to work on some impressions. The political thing came mostly from the writers, Jim Downey, Seth Meyers, people coming to me and saying, hey, can you do Tony Blair? And then you would go and watch Tony Blair before the table reading. I'd walk in on a Wednesday, which was a table read day, and I remember Seth Meyers very clearly coming up to me and saying, Downey just wrote a cold open where you play Elliot Spitzer. Do you have an Elliot Spitzer? And I said, who's Elliot Spitzer? And Seth is like, you're an idiot. One, he was our governor. I know nothing. So it was like, go watch this tape, watch him give this speech, and figure this out, you dummy. And then I would figure it out, and I learned I was a pretty quick study at this stuff. Jim Downey would talk about handles. He taught me about handles. You know, you want to find someone who has a big handle. It's very easy and fun to impersonate them if they have a big handle, something you can grab onto. Obama has no handle, and so Jay did a very good job of finding little things about him. But it's really hard. That's why I think I always liked doing old movie stars, because they have, like, huge handles. They're not even real. People now are much more, I don't know, grounded is the most polite way to say it. James Carville came in when we did those Thursday night specials during the election season. On Thursday morning, Steve Higgins called me and said, hey, they're writing a James Carville for you, so go learn James Carville. You're doing it tonight. I found this YouTube footage of James Carville and started working on it. And then I came in and did it for them in the room and kept working on it some more. So when you saw that first one, that was the day of. That would happen to everyone who did impressions. Will Ferrell, cast member. I think once you've impersonated a president and then you leave the show, it's like I get asked in a press junket, do you have a good Obama up your sleeve? And I'm like, no, I don't at all. A, I'm not an impressionist. Once I left the show, I stopped trying to think of political impressions. But also, Obama is difficult. He's very dry and subtle. And yet you see Jay and the people get it down and you're like, oh, there's the impression. Jay Farrow. I hadn't heard anything from the White House, but then I did an event last year, and I heard it from him. It was at Harvey Weinstein's house. Very nice. I'd never been there. His house is gorgeous. I thought, oh, wow, if I can get this someday. It was just an opportunity. I was trying to take my makeup off because I was him for him at this event, and he stood right there watching me do it. He was laughing. It was so petrifying. And I heard from his administration that he loves the impression, that he thinks it's great. As long as there's no beef between me and the president, that's good. When that happens, you're Kanye West.